Well, we got to get Evan to get a dog.
Yes, okay. Yes,
Evan, this it is, really
no,
is
no, I'll tell you.
Your kids are getting big.
And unfortunately,
it's time.
And my kids are getting very sophisticated in
good.
Their lobbying. So,
right,
Rosie,
so they got a PowerPoint going? That's when
Rosie,
you know you're going to have to cave.
She said, so, Daddy, you are allergic to animal fur. Is that correct? I said, yeah. She said, so what about getting one of those dogs that has no hair on it? And I was like, duh. And I said, but Rosie, we have a fish named Freddy, but you don't play very much with the fish. And she's like, Daddy, it's very hard to play with a fish.
Well, you know, she's a smart girl smart parents. I will say that, you know, fair warning, if you do cave in, everyone will say, oh, well, there's a contract on the internet. You know, your kids, you make them sign it. They're going to walk the dog. Guess what? Everybody signs the contract. No one fulfills the contract. You will walk the dog. It will be your dog.
But it's good for you to walk the dog. It, the one thing I find as I'm working on a book, like I barely move, but my dog does not take no for an answer.
Yes.
So, but the thing is, keeping me alive.
We have enough of those kinds of pressures in our life. Like, I don't think I need another creature asking.
Yes, you do.
To have its needs met.
You do.
Really?
Yes, you do.
Hold on.
Which
Who sent you? Did the dog send you?
I'm just saying, okay, I've been reading a manuscript for what's a wonderful book by a judge named David Tatel, who you know.
Hear, hear.
Okay, and he is blind. He's a federal judge, and he managed to have an incredible career. And what's the secret ingredient? Vixen.
I know. And you know what? It
dog.
Is true.
His
and you're right.
Dog.
And his love of this dog. And as he says, he wished he had gotten a guide dog much earlier in his life. It is completely irresistible, and I find the book, I loved it, and it's, I honestly never thought I could be charmed by a dog, particularly a
wow, dog
a working
literature.
Dog.
Right. I'm just saying, case closed.
Well, the other point to consider, Evan, is as your kids get older, that's the reason why people tend to get dogs as the families head into the tween years, because you're going to be needing some uncritical love.
Oh, you're so right. I'm not there yet.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
All right, I'll remember
There's
that.
There's a correlation is all I'm saying.
Welcome to The Political Scene, a weekly discussion about the big questions in American politics. I'm Jane Mayer, and I'm joined by my colleagues Evan Osnos and Susan Glasser. Hi, Evan.
Hey, Jane.
Hey, Susan.
Hey there. Great to be with you.
Hi. So, Donald Trump is on trial. Almost exactly a year since being charged with falsifying business records in order to cover up a payment to Stormy Daniels, the adult film star he allegedly had an affair with, sordid facts which he allegedly wanted to keep voters from learning about, Trump now finds himself in court. The, quote, hush money trial officially began in New York this week. It's the first of Trump's four criminal indictments to come to trial. And after months of speculation and anticipation, we're finally seeing what it means for a former president to sit before a judge in criminal court while also, of course, running for re-election. So, what has the first week of this historic trial taught us? What have we learned about the particular case as well as how it might shape the campaign to come? What stood out to you guys so far?
I'll tell you one fun thing that I've enjoyed watching is the jury selection process. It's this moment in which you get this wonderfully New York diversity of people. You've got the Lebanese wealth manager who does yoga. You've got the teacher who lives on the Lower East Side who wasn't aware that Trump is on trial in three other cases. There's this kind of very sort of a subway car full of America. And the collision between that and Trump in his kind of imperial seclusion, I find quite electric.
Well, and in fact, it's not imperial seclusion, which is the other kind of fascinating aspect of this, right? You have Donald Trump sitting there just a few feet away from these jurors as they're asked their opinions about him, as they're asked to, you know, reflect on can they render judgment in an impartial way about him. You know, the idea of him, for once, being outside of the bubble, also outside of being able to do whatever he wants. You know, this is the judge's courtroom very much. So I feel like we're seeing this kind of almost morality play take shape, right? Like, this is a system in which Trump is just but a citizen. He's citizen Trump for the purposes of this trial. But I have to say, I've been feeling a lot of empathy and, you know, kind of discomfort for these jurors, right? You wake up in the morning,
right.
you go,
right.
You have this jury summons, maybe you've tried to get out of it. This is your third time. You got to go this time. You show up at the courthouse and then, boom, within hours, you have Donald Trump's lawyers raking over your social media posts or even your spouse's social media posts from 6 years ago, looking for anything on you. You face the possibility, if you get on this jury, of this enormous blowback. Look at how they weaponize so quickly. So I feel
weird,
bad
a little
for
bit
these
of
folks.
I think it's a little bit of a catch-22. Mm. Basically, if you're really well-informed and maybe plugged into social media, which, of course, is where, you know, the dialogue takes place about politics a lot of the time now. If you're really well-informed, you're not likely to get onto this jury.
But you know what's interesting? I talked not too long ago. I talked to somebody who has spent many years in a courtroom. I won't say the details, but one of the takeaways was that juries take this incredibly seriously. This is something that I didn't appreciate, is that the instructions to the jury are often incredibly literally interpreted. So what's kind of fascinating is you take this group of people who, as Susan said, you know, started the day as private citizens and will end this process in some other status. But along the way, they tend to be really earnest about the process. And I find that
I think
exciting.
Well, I've been on a jury. And, you know, the other thing that I think we have to think about is it only takes one to make it a hung jury. So everybody's looking very closely at it to try to figure out who it is. Okay, it looks to us like we may have our guest, today's guest, Andrea Bernstein. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, everyone.
She is a reporter for NPR, co-host of the podcast Trump Inc., and author of American Oligarchs, The Kushners, The Trumps, and The Marriage of Money and Power. She's been covering Trump both in and out of the courtroom for quite some time. Andrea, welcome to the show.
I'm such a big fan of the show. It's great to talk to all of you.
Thank you for coming on.
Great to have you.
Can't wait to hear, because we're just sitting here in a room in Washington, but you've been in the room. We want to know.
Yes.
Tell us, is it as dingy?
Yeah, right. Is it as dingy as it keeps being described?
And cold? Actually, you are there now, right?
Here, I'm going to give you a cameo.
Oh. All right. Guess what? This is an audio podcast, basically it's a completely plain hallway. That's what we're seeing.
I am going to describe it. It is like really old and cruddy. The marble's chitting. The bathroom doors don't really close. They can't get the temperature right in the courtroom. It's either boiling or freezing. It is such a long, long way conceptually, but a short distance from Trump Tower. It's gold and it's marble and it's waterfall.
So just tell us, I mean, you've covered a number of trials, including Trump trials. Is this one different in any kind of way that you can tell?
Yes. The idea that Trump's liberty is at stake came into stark relief on Monday when the judge read Trump his so-called Parker rights, which are read to all defendants. But when he said to Trump, if you act in a way that's disruptive, I can expel you and send you to jail. And if you don't show up for courtroom, I can issue a warrant for your arrest. And if you don't show up for sentencing, I can prosecute you for bail jumping. It all really, really sinks in.
Do you get the sense, Andrea, now that he is becoming a bit of an old hand at being in court? You know, after all, there was the civil fraud trial. There's the E. Jean Carroll case, which you've covered. Are you seeing that he is behaving any differently than he did when this all started?
One of the things that was so striking to me, beginning in the fraud trial, which started in October. So that was the first trial that he actually attended in person. And it was kind of shocking to me because I had covered two previous trials, the trial of his business and the first E. Jean Carroll trial, where he just seemed to want to be as far away as he could be. And he started to come, and I was so surprised when he said he was going to come, because I was like, why would he want to associate himself with all this kind of tawdry, unlawful behavior? But he would come every day, and he would pass this scrum of reporters, and he would stand behind the barricades, which, you know, he's savvy. He's a former TV star. He knows how to set up a shot. He was sort of sending a message. I'm behind bars. They want to put me behind bars. And every day he said the same thing that he said today, just minutes ago, which was, I should be in South Carolina. I should be in Georgia. I should be in another state, but I have to be here. In that case, he didn't have to be. The difference in this one is that he does have to be. He has no choice. He has to be here every day, every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday until this is over. And he literally cannot go out on the trail. So it's a different dynamic. I know that 17 cents is important to Trump because I've read some of his business contracts where he demanded 17 cents from every minibar purchase. $83 million is also a lot of money for Trump. But what is really important is this question of criminality. And he seems more upset, more tired, and more frustrated at having to spend his days in here. I mean, he has finally been told his liberty is not his. He wanted to go to the Supreme Court arguments next week in the immunity trial. And the judge said to him, well, that seems very important, but you are a criminal defendant in my courtroom, so you'll be here.
You know, that is so interesting. I mean, I do think it's important to note that we're still in the pregame show as far as the trial goes, right? We've seen a week of jury selection and we've seen some early rulings. I'm just curious, you know, do you feel like you know anything more about the case as we get ready for the opening arguments next week? We're going to see prosecutors present this idea essentially that this is not even so much a hush money case as it is an election interference case. But I'm curious, like, what your assessment is going into the actual substantive part of the trial.
Yes, I would say the Manhattan DA's case has gotten clearer and clearer. When Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg announced this case about a year ago, we were all kind of confused. What is the underlying crime? What's the argument? Why did he falsify these records? Was it to violate New York law? Was it to violate federal law? But just Monday of this week, before jury selection started, we really got some insight into what their case is going to be. And they've simplified it, which is probably good for them. You don't want a really complicated story to present to jurors. And the evidence that they are presenting, or will present, so they've said, is that beginning in August of 2015, so really soon, right? We're talking just 2 months after the escalator ride down to the marble atrium of Trump Tower. Donald Trump, David Pecker, and Michael Cohen met at Trump Tower and came to this agreement that Pecker, who was the publisher of the National Enquirer, would keep his eyes out for negative stories on Trump and would figure out ways to suppress them and would, in fact, write stories that would help Donald Trump's campaign. And then we learned on Monday that, so you may remember there was this recent document dump that came from federal prosecutors that Trump tried to delay the trial over. And in those documents, we learned, were internal campaign documents from the Trump campaign that show this rising panic after the Access Hollywood tape, where Trump said he wanted to grab women by the genitals, that they were so worried. And here is the DA's argument. This is the moment that Stormy Daniels steps in. And Trump had just said, oh, well, that Access Hollywood tape, it was all locker room talk. But here was a real person saying, I had an affair with Donald Trump when he was married to Melania, and I'm going to come forward. And that's what caused them to go into this overdrive and to take these measures to suppress her story and to suppress another story of a actually even longer affair with a Playboy model named Karen McDougal, which the New Yorker had written about greatly. And that was the motivation.
So, Andrea, what you're saying is basically this is not just a trial about a tawdry affair and hush money.
Exactly.
And why do you think that's going to make such a big difference?
I think it's a pretty easy story to understand. And I mean, I think to the extent that Trump has articulated a defense other than this is a rigged political witch hunt, the defense has been he didn't want to embarrass his family. He didn't want Melania to know. That's why he did this. But the DA is saying, no, we have evidence that this was a campaign strategy, that they were so worried that especially women voters at the end of the campaign would move away from him if they got this information. And That is what the DA is alleging. That's why they not only paid the hush money, but then took such elaborate steps to cover it up, paying Michael Cohen $420,000, which they described as a legal retainer. When in fact, there was no legal retainer with Michael Cohen. It was reimbursement for hush money that he had paid to cover up the then would-be president's affair with a porn star.
So you've seen some of this team in court before. I'm just curious if you have any sense of Bragg and of the prosecutorial team. What do you think of them?
So some of the prosecutors on this case also prosecuted the business felony case back in December of 2022. So most people forgot about that case. I almost forgot about that case. But that was a case where there was an accusation that Trump's business had unlawfully paid its employees with untaxed benefits like luxury cars and apartments. And his former CFO, Alan Weisselberg, was a big recipient, receiving, among other things, tuition for his grandchildren to go to private school directly from Donald Trump. So that case seemed like it would be very complicated and kind of also it was pretty boring. There were a lot of business records, a lot of accountants and bookkeepers testifying, but the jury came back very quickly. It was quite a clear story that they had presented. And Trump's company was found guilty on all 17 counts. Mm. So that's the same team that is prosecuting this case. And I do think that over the past year, they have sort of figured out what their story is.
I am struck by the fact that every single time Donald Trump ends up in court, there seems to be some new defense lawyer, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, that we're never seen from again. This guy, Todd Blanche, is now generally described as a capable lawyer. Have you formed a sense of how this defense team looks?
So Todd Blanche, who has been so far leading the defense team. I mean, he is a respected defense lawyer in New York. He himself was a former prosecutor. Susan Nicholas, who is the other main lawyer, is extremely well respected here. But one time, some time ago, an employee who had worked inside the Trump organization told me that Trump always hired fake lawyers when it didn't matter, and real lawyers when it matters.
So it matters.
That's very interesting.
I have one final question.
Okay, I was just going to say, I'm sure he still misses. He always says, get me my Roy Cohn.
Right. Exactly. Where's my Roy Cohn? Yeah.
Well, right. Roy Cohn, by the way, it's worth remembering that Roy Cohn felt so betrayed by Donald Trump.
Yes.
That he said at the end, Donald Trump pisses ice water.
Yeah. So
he too was, I know he's the sort of, you know, pinnacle of Trump lawyers, but he too was thrown out at the end by him, or felt he was. Mm.
They all cycle through in the end. So my final question is just, okay, the jury is now seated, although they might lose more, but what's the zeitgeist? What does it feel like, you know, in the room there? Does this, you know, that there's more men than women? I took note of that. You know, there's it's diverse, as Evan said, but, you know, in a way, you are screening out people who probably know more and have thought more about Trump than others. So what's your vibe on this jury?
I mean, my sense of the jury is that they've weeded out. I mean, what is so different about this case is you can't say, have you ever heard of the defendant? Normally, if you know the defendant or have an opinion on the defendant, you're off the jury. But everybody knows the defendant in this case. Most people have opinions. What they're screening for here is something really different from what they're screening for in other cases, which is kind of an intensity of feeling or a surfeit of knowledge. So they've gotten those people off the jury. And, you know, there are people I know it'll be really confusing to listeners of the political scene, but there are people who don't spend every moment thinking about Trump.
Really?
That is sort of does seem to be who they have found for this jury. I mean, it is a Manhattan jury. It's highly educated. I think there are two MBAs. There are two lawyers. There are people in the health profession. It actually does feel like a group of Manhattanites.
Real Americans.
I mean, you know, it's a jury of Donald Trump's peers, or at least his peers at the time this occurred. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, New Yorkers know Trump in a different way, as you know, than other people do. So people were like, well, I saw him in Marla shopping, or I like the way he fixed the Woolman Rink in Central Park. I mean, these are, you know,
real
old
New Yorkers.
New York
yeah.
stories.
That's it.
I mean, and it, doesn't it seem fair in the end of the day? I know he feels that he's been claiming he can't get a fair trial in Manhattan, but this is his town,
yeah.
You know? I mean, and isn't that really basically what you're supposed to face when you're charged with something?
I mean, we have not spoken to any of the former Trump jurors, so we don't know what they're thinking. But, you know, looking from the outside, it seems they are really reckoning with the evidence before them. And one thing I do know about DA Alvin Bragg is he did not wish to bring a gratuitous case against Trump. So he must think that he can win this case. Mm. And in certain of his rulings, Judge Mershon has attested to the seriousness of it. So we will see going forward.
Bring
thank
it on.
You, Andrea. keep us informed. And for people who can only hear and not see, let me just say, she's got an extra layer of clothing on. Stay warm in there.
Yes. Yeah, don't fall asleep. Did you fall asleep?
Oh, I could never fall asleep. I did position myself closer to the big monitor so I could observe more closely the sleep schedule or not of the former president.
All right.
Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you for doing important work for all of us.
Okay, great talking to you. Bye-bye.
The political scene from The New Yorker will be back in just a moment.
You come to The New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So, guys, we just heard from Andrea Bernstein, who's covering the trial. What stood out for you?
I have to say, there is something.
It does look dingy, doesn't it?
Well, Andrea was sitting under a sign that said Forensic Psychiatry Clinic, pointing in the other direction, not the courtroom.
But it's those long corridors without any adornment.
Yeah,
the waxed
all
floor, the, you know.
Yeah, well, in some ways, I thought Andrea's point is a really good one about the aesthetic and physical contrast between the world that Donald Trump seeks to express, this
yes,
kind of
yeah,
gilded, imagined idea of luxury and power and privilege, and the physical expression of accountability that he is now faced with on a daily basis, where not only is he in this courtroom, but the guy has to campaign at bodegas because he can't get to South Carolina to campaign.
Although he also, I have to say, when you looked at his campaign appearance out after the first day of jury selection in a New York City bodega, he had a big smile on his face, and maybe it was just getting out of the Dickensian courtroom. But I do think that, you know, Donald Trump, he said this revealing thing. He said, there's so many cameras here. There must be more cameras here than anywhere else. And for Donald Trump, where the cameras are, there is life. And, you know, I mean, really, he is almost a virtual person in the sense that he at this point craves and needs the lights of the cameras on him at all times. And remember, he hadn't been doing a ton of actual campaigning. He had been down to a tempo of once a week, Saturday night
absolutely
rallies.
I mean, this business about being deprived, I think you have to be a little skeptical about his deprived of his busy schedule. He was barely leaving Mar-a-Lago before this. So,
well, he's exhausted, as you can tell. The man is just clearly wiped out. And sleep is important. You have to get your sleep.
Well, you know, when you're up at 2 a.m. and the demons are causing you to post on Truth Social, you know, your rants about the judge in your case, the judge's family in the case, probably the witnesses in the case, despite the gag order, you know, we'll see if he's fulminating about the betrayals of his favorite congressman on Capitol Hill this week. But, you know, I'm interested in the spectacle, but I would also point out that, you know, we're the junkies. We're following it very closely. This is not a televised trial. And that was one thing we didn't talk about with Andrea. But I just wonder, what do you guys think about how much the rest of the world will actually pay attention to?
Oh, I think this one's a pretty juicy subject matter. I mean, this is a tawdry kind of tabloidy thing. And I think people will follow it. I really do. this involves porn stars and infidelity, sex. No,
it's, but it's not televised.
Yeah,
it's but people are going to, I actually think, in a way, to build on Susan's point, this is keeping all the cameras on Trump, despite the fact that he's in a courtroom and not visible. He comes out at the breaks, he talks, you know, the reporters rush out and give their reports. It's live TV a lot of the time on the new, on the cable news shows. I mean, this is keeping the cameras rolling on him again.
I also think that, and Andrea made this important point, reminding us about a case that most of us have already forgotten, the business felony case involving Alan Weisselberg. So by now you have a series of cases in which Trump has lost. Business felony case, civil fraud case, E. Jean Carroll case. You know, this notion that this guy who spent a career bobbing and weaving and was so clever about managing all of the legal risks, he would always, you know, he was too smart to say something wrong on tape. All of that is over. The man is now permanently and constantly in legal jeopardy. The narrative about him is now so completely in sort of in the courtroom that it's almost banal to see him in court one more day. And at a certain point, you know, this idea of the old Teflon Don is just finished. The guy is now a creature of the court.
Well, yeah, all right. Listen, we have to take a break for a minute here. But when we come back, we're going to talk more about what this actually means for the 2024 election and the two campaigns.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election: guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
This trial is expected to last for at least 6 weeks, and Trump's required to be there in person, as we've said, every day that the court is in session, which is 4 days a week. So, Susan, how do you think the Trump team is planning to campaign while he is literally in court?
Well, look, I mean, let's be clear that in some ways this reinforces Trump's message of grievance and persecution. And in that sense, he is amplifying that every day, as you pointed out before, on the courthouse steps and his whatever he does after the court, in his voluminous and not necessarily accurate social media postings and frantic fundraising. Please, the message is all the same, right? The message is, they are weaponizing the courts against me. This is a political prosecution slash persecution. It never would have been brought against anybody else. This is just the way politics is fought, and you're seeking to turn that into a criminal case and embarrass me, but I'm going to turn it around on you. And that worked for Donald Trump to a certain extent in the primaries. I think you have to look at the evidence and say that the bringing of this indictment a year ago, combined with then three more criminal indictments, was something that Trump used very effectively to communicate with the fervent Republican hard right base. And he used that in a way to stop any momentum that any other potential Republican challenger had against him. He reconsolidated Republicans around him with this message of grievance and persecution. Now, we've moved into a general election context. And I have to say, that's where we don't know the answer yet. Because remember, this is unprecedented. This is such a historic moment. I'm looking at the percentage of Republicans, call it 20, 25% of Republicans, depending on the polls, who aren't fervent MAGA Republicans. Some subset of them is uncomfortable with the idea of a felon as the president of the United States. And if he is convicted in this, you don't need 20% of Republicans not to vote for Trump. You need just a small percentage in key battleground states to say enough is enough. I'm not voting for a felon. I'm done with this. And I don't know what the answer. And anybody who tells you, I think, that they know what the answer is really selling you the Brooklyn Bridge at this point. But I do think that that actually is a genuine factor. I don't want to overblow it because Republicans again and again and again have found a way to make excuses for Trump. But I don't know. I mean, do you guys have a different sentiment?
Yeah, I'm just curious, Evan, what do you think? I mean, he's been trying to make it out that, I mean, his line on the trial is in boiled down, this is the Biden trial against him. It's all politics. There's nothing real here.
Yeah.
Is it going to work?
Well, I mean, I think that part of the response that you've seen from Biden's side is to say, let's keep this at arm's length. So you don't hear Biden talking about this case every day. I mean, the obvious temptation here would be for him to get up and say, while I'm out here doing the people's business, this guy's in court defending himself from blah, blah, blah. The Biden side has made a real decision not to do that. Now, there's a lot of easy criticism. You could say, well, couldn't he and shouldn't he be doing this? But like, he gets in little digs here and there. When he was in Pennsylvania this week, when he's going around and actually campaigning for president, he said at one point, under my predecessor, I'm reading here, he says, under my predecessor, who's a little busy right now, Pennsylvania lost 275,000 jobs. There's another, I took note of one of the campaign official, Quentin Folk, said, we don't think that the American people are sitting around their kitchen table thinking about if Donald Trump is sleeping in court. So they're getting their ways of talking about the case without reinforcing, as Susan said, this narrative of Trump being persecuted by Biden, which is actually helpful in rallying Trump's people.
Well, I'll come in with what you call the easy criticism and just run with the easy criticism. I mean, I think that they're taking quite a risk in assuming that if you take the high road and don't bring this up while the entire country is watching this spectacle, that people will just come to the right conclusions on their own, because there's a massive sort of propaganda campaign on the side of Trump and all of the media that's aligned with him, saying this is an unfair situation and undermining the credibility and trust in the American legal system. He's putting the justice system on trial. And I think without having to come out and have Biden take a swipe directly at Trump, that he has almost an obligation to defend the justice system and say, you know, the court system, one of the wonderful things in this country is that no matter how important you are, how powerful you are, you're still subject to the rule of law, and we'll see how it comes out.
Well,
you know, something like that. Because if he doesn't bolster the court system, who will? You know?
Well, I think this is an important point, Jane, is that this is what you're seeing from Trump and his very loud amplifiers is part of a sustained assault on the court system and on many of the other institutions of American government. That's in their playbook. That is something. And they've had remarkable success, by the way. It is part of eroding confidence. And, you know, norms being shattered, I thought during the jury selection this week, my breath was kind of taken away when I realized that some of Trump's followers were even going to go there of attacking jurors, going after them essentially by name. And what you had as a direct result of this kind of media surround sound, you know, hallelujah chorus for Donald Trump was one of the jurors who had been picked, who had been seated on the jury, an oncology nurse. Mm. She comes back in the next day and she says, you know, my family is worried about me. They clearly were able to identify me based on the information that was provided. And I think that this is another norm that is being attacked by Donald Trump and his amplifiers in the media. And I'm very worried about it because I think that it's part of the eroding civic space. I think it's part of the culture of political violence that we saw that led to January 6th. And I think that it's not to be discounted in my mind. What's going to happen to some of Donald Trump's more rabid followers if and when he is convicted of a felony and led away to jail at some point, you know, probably far in the future? It's hard to conceive of how the system holds up under that.
I mean, absolutely. I've heard some lawyers who've done, you know, mafia kinds of trials say that that's a sort of a mob trial dynamic that you don't see very often in this country, where jurors are really afraid and feeling threatened like that. And the idea that of all cases, the case that where people would feel like this is one involving a former president is really pretty shocking.
And also, to your point, Jane, you know, how could Biden talk about this without politicizing the prosecution in a way that would play right into Trump's hands. Look, one of the ways that he has talked about it is by saying very explicitly that Trump is going to court and is losing. I mean, it's just what he said in a speech when he was talking about the attempts to overturn the election. He said Trump lost 60 court cases. 60. Trump lost the Republican-controlled state. So he's describing the legal process as the measure of whether Trump is fit to be reelected. I think keep it in the realm of seriousness. Don't say, in effect, you know, isn't it a mistake to vote for a man who's on trial in all these ways. Just sort of remind people that this guy is a loser in court. That's the approach.
And I think, Evan, to your point earlier, I'm struck by how people have just been quite willing to glide over these very serious civil cases that have involved Trump. And, you know, by the way, the criminal trial of his business organization, in which they were forced to pay nearly half a $1 billion fine for being essentially a fraudulent business enterprise in New York State. The Trump organization, it's not some big anonymous corporate entity. That essentially is Donald Trump. That's not only a family-run business, but he was the micromanaging owner and proprietor of the Trump Organization. Finding the Trump Organization guilty was finding Donald Trump guilty. And people have sort of glided over that, glided over, in a way, the E. Jean Carroll case, a remarkable finding of a man who was president and who would be president again, that he essentially was guilty of sexual assault in this civil case. That was the finding. Again, disqualifying for anyone, any politician we've ever seen before. And yet that's why, Jane, I am questioning the extent to which people are really going to be tuned in to the details of this case. I think that it's an important thing. The moment will likely register on people. But I think again and again and again, we've normalized, we've become accustomed to the unthinkable with Donald Trump. And my guess is that once again, we've already known about this hush money payment to Stormy Daniels for years. It hasn't changed fundamentally Americans' views of Donald Trump.
I just think when you have Stormy Daniels coming out of the courtroom and repeating her charges and Karen McDougal, all this.
They've been on TV for years saying these things already.
I really do think it'll capture people's imagination. What I'm not sure of, though, is whether a conviction is going to make that much difference if there is one. And I also think there hasn't been much discussion of the possibility that he'll be acquitted. And if he's acquitted, then what do you do?
Or hung jury.
Or a hung jury.
That is and that's part of the reason why Joe Biden is not talking about it. Because it strikes me that, you know, you can't lean in too far to this because you don't know.
It's just, you know, there's something so artificial about paying no attention to it from the White House when you know they're watching it every minute and it is the center of the campaign. And so to sort of pretend
but
that
maybe
it's not something happening.
But maybe it's not. Maybe it's not the center of the campaign.
It's the
politically
center of
speaking,
the coverage of the campaign. We're going to be seeing this will be an incredible spectacle.
Look,
one way or another.
From my view, next week's arguments in the Supreme Court maybe the more important legal proceeding.
It's far drier, though. You know, the issue of immunity, I agree. I think it's incredibly important. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Maybe because I'm a native New Yorker, I think those tabloids pack a punch. Now, I have one last question I had for you guys, which is, how do you feel about this, of all the possible trials, being the one that's coming first? What do you think? I mean, there's been a lot of debate about whether this charge is something that is going to seem fair to people.
Well, I've noticed, you know, for a long time, this was, of course, the sort of runt of the litter. People were saying this is the lousiest of the cases. There's been a bit of an evolution in that thinking among legal experts. And Eric Latch, who writes for us, wrote a really good, smart piece at the beginning of this trial in which he went back, talked to some of the people who had been early skeptics who are now saying, you know, as a matter of fact, this case is stronger than I thought. It's a straightforward case, as you guys have said. There's a strong paper trail. And the motive here, which was to try to rescue the Trump campaign after the Access Hollywood tape, that is clear and comprehensible. And so it's actually a better case than it looked at the beginning. And I think, Susan, you described it earlier as a sort of morality play in many ways. And Eric has this analogy that I think is true, which is it's a bit like the Seinfeld finale or the Curb Your Enthusiasm finale, where you have this sort of bit players from this long narrative coming back to face the protagonist. And it has a clarifying.
I mean, it's a bit of an Al Capone situation, too, isn't it? You know, something that seems like a lesser infraction that might actually have huge consequences in the courts.
Well, look, to me, it is actually appropriate in that it is the quintessence of how Donald Trump operates. It is, if you want to see a case study of how dirty politics works and the manipulation that goes on, the way in which Donald Trump employed fixers and crooked tabloid owners and, you know, the seamy world in which he operated. So in that sense, it's Donald Trump in full. It has a sort of, you know, New York City novel, except it's true, feel to it, in the same way that this entire 8 years of Donald Trump in our American political psyche has had a feeling of, you know, this can't possibly be true, and yet it is. And so it's perfectly appropriate that it should be a tabloid trial about a tabloid president.
Perfect. I mean, true. And it's about election interference again. And that's been the running theme. So it actually, it is the prelude to the rest of these chapters. But anyway, listen, thank you guys so much. So great to be with you.
Thank you, Jane.
Yeah, thank you. We'll be tuning in on Monday to, you know, hear what happens in those legal arguments. But to the point, we won't be watching them.
That is true. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker, and I'm Jane Mayer. If you have thoughts on the show or questions, please send them to themail@newyorker.com. And don't forget to include The Political Scene in the subject line. We had production assistance today from Alex D'Elia and Dan Richards, and with editing from Gianna Palmer. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Condé Nast's head of global audio is Chris Bannon, and our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown.
Before we go this week, we want to take a moment to give a special thanks to our friend and, alas, our departing producer, Dan Richards. Dan has produced our show for the last year with tremendous creativity and care and incredible speed on a very tight deadline. Dan, we are so grateful for the work you've done for the show, and we'll be cheering you on from afar. Thanks again.
And we'll be back next week. Thanks so much for listening.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of The Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read The Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.